Missing this?
I remember Ollie texted me Solskjaer. One or two people would get hold of my number, unfortunately, and he would text me.
Then get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Chasing down the competition with the momentum of a Man United Champions League charge.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
I'm prepared to anything I can. Well,
do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
All right, it's a Thursday night football show. Nathan with you for the next hour. We will talk to Daniel Storey a little bit later on about Nottingham Forest's capitulation in the final moments of the Championship season, which saw them miss out on the playoffs. Could well be a dramatic final day in the Premier League as well on Sunday. All 10 matches getting underway at 4 o'clock. We'll have reporters at all the games, goals as they happen, and full live and exclusive commentary of Leicester against Manchester United with Stephen Doyle and Brian Kerr in that battle for the Champions League places, keeping a close eye on that relegation fight as well. So that all to come on Sunday. Right now, though, I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Mark Lawrenson. Evening, Mark.
Nathan, you okay?
I'm hanging in there. Did you get to Anfield last night?
No. You have to have an invite.
And you're not on the guest list?
Well, I can't. Under what guise can I go? I think there was hardly any ex-players there that are, unless they were working. So no, it was fine. I just watched it at home on the telly, but it was surreal in many ways, wasn't it?
It was. We were doing commentary on the game last night, myself and Brian Kerr, and you know, you're commentating on the trophy lift and trying to describe what it means, and at the same time, it just doesn't feel right that there aren't 50,000 Liverpool supporters there waiting for this moment that for three decades they've waited for. And listen, there's obviously greater things going on in the world, but one of the great things I always find about going to Anfield is that there are so many ex-players there. You're in the press room, you're around the place, everywhere you look there's a legend, there's a player who has four or five league titles, and Jason McAteer is there as well. Like, you're all there. You should have been there. You should have been there last night. It's a real shame that you couldn't have all got back together.
Yeah, well, it would be great, but hey, you know, another day, another dollar, no doubt. So, and I think as well the fact, you know, that the night obviously that they won it when City got beat at Chelsea as well, and I think it was a strange one. Even getting presented the trophy in the middle of the cop just didn't seem right somehow, did it? I don't know. Anyway, they've won the league. That's all that matters, basically.
Just talking about Liverpool, and you were saying it doesn't look as though they're going to sign. And again, part of the problem is when you have a team that got to the level that Liverpool got to this season, where does somebody fit in and where do they get the game time? But all those other teams probably will go and strengthen. And Manchester City are talking about, with the transfer ban not in place, and Chelsea with no transfer ban, of spending big, maybe over 100 million for both of them. Manchester United at their best strengthened from a position of strength. Is there a real risk for Liverpool of sticking with what would essentially be the same squad for two seasons in a row? Okay, Minamino came in January. But do you not automatically, like, you played in, what was it, five title-winning sides with Liverpool. Yeah. Do you not need to be refreshing the squad constantly?
Yeah, you do. I think maybe Klopp feels that part of that addressing for him has been the introduction of the three young lads who won't play, I don't think, regularly next year, but they'll probably get more game time. I just think he looks around and I think he's just thinking, well, I'm not quite sure who he's going to get and who he really wants. And, you know, obviously talked about the money, etc., because the front three are almost set in stone. So, I mean, are you going to ask, that's why we basically got Minamino, because they think that he'll grow into the role. I mean, Origi's come on as substitute, started the odd game. We know he's not anything like the or has the ability of the front three that we already have. But that's the most difficult thing: is who's going to come, because you know that person or persons would want to play regular football. I know you're Casey Reid, and someone's got a contract saying, "Oh, he's got to play so many games," which is absolute rubbish because no manager would ever do that. But
should they be that set in stone? Like, Roberto Firmino last night finally got his goal at Anfield, his first in the Premier League this season. He wears that number. He wears that number nine jersey. I know he's not the out and out striker, and he drops deep. And he's, some would say, he's the key figure of the three of those.
And I would be one of them.
Right.
Because he's the glue. He's the glue to the other two. Because if you watch the other two, who are outstanding players, they go all over the place. Which, you know, they're allowed to do. It's part of the system. But generally, Firmino is always central to everything. His movement's far because he's a problem, because he plays away from central defenders but behind holding midfield players. He's got fantastic awareness, and you know, everyone makes a big thing about the goals and stuff like that, but you know, they've just won the league, seven games to go, and in terms of his play, he's as good as anybody. Yes, he'd probably like to score more goals, but hell, he makes an awful lot of chances and pulls in all sorts of holes for the other. If you ask the other two, Salah and Mane, about Firmino, they would just wax lyrical about him all the time, and the manager certainly does.
Salah's a peculiar one when it comes to Liverpool supporters. In many ways, last night's performance sums up a lot of their fears around them. How many chances did he need? And he didn't score, and you could see his frustration when he was been taken off without getting the goal. And there's a sense of, well, does he contribute enough if he's not scoring? And does he take enough of his chances? And then you just look at the statistics. And if he'd scored last night, I think he'd be the first Liverpool player since Roger Hunt to score 20 league goals in three consecutive seasons.
Yeah.
Golden boot the first two seasons, 19 so far this season. Are there parts of his game that you can understand why people get frustrated? Or are expectations just sometimes, when it comes to Liverpool, unrealistically high?
No, I can understand. And I think players that play with him get a little bit frustrated because he's always looking to score, when we know occasionally it would be a better place to pass it into to one of the other boys. But, you know, the stat you've just given me, that 20 goals, three consecutive seasons, is incredible. Because I think if you asked a lot of people when we signed him, they thought he was kind of, you know, a left winger, which he sort of was at Chelsea, or, you know, could also play on the right. And basically, Klopp's just turned him into a right-sided goal machine, you know, which is, I mean, that in itself, to see the vision that, you know, well, of the three of them, just to see the vision of the three of them is amazing. And he's improved all three ways, improved every single player apart from the goalkeeper, the old goalkeeper, Karius. But, you know, it's one of, yes, people do get a bit frustrated with him. And I think he gets angry with himself when he doesn't score. He does need a lot of chances, but how many goals did we score this year? And as I say, you know, won the league seven games before the end, which as we know, has been unheard of, even in the history of the football club.
We'll find out who the Footballer of the Year is this weekend. It could well be Kevin De Bruyne. Liverpool supporters can't have too much to complain about, considering the 2 years Manchester City were so dominant. Mo Salah and Virgil van Dijk were Footballers of the Year, but it seems to be between Kevin De Bruyne and Jordan Henderson, with maybe Virgil van Dijk and Trent Alexander-Arnold be in the mix. Jordan Henderson is obviously this totemic figure, the real talisman of this Liverpool side, who has improved massively himself and is a great personal story and how he's come on over the last 10 years. Does he deserve to be in the reckoning alongside the player of Kevin De Bruyne's calibre?
Yeah, I think he does. I think he does. You know, for all the reasons you've just said, but plus, of course, as well, captain of a team that's won the league seven games early. He's improved. I think the thing with Jordan now is when the ball gets played into him, he looks forward all the time, where there was a spell which frustrated everybody, myself included, where he'd pass it sideways, he'd pass it backwards. And he's matured, basically. And also, by the way, you know, with a lot of the stories about the footballers in lockdown with COVID, coronavirus and stuff, he was fabulous. He's, you know, Liverpool came out with the furlough system, and everyone went, oh my goodness, what have they done? But he's come out as a real leader. We know he's a leader on the pitch, etc. But, you know, spoken with an awful lot of sense. I personally, if I was voting, I would vote for Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah.
You're going to say, why would you vote for him? I'll tell you why I vote for him, because would we win the league without Jordan Henderson? Yes. Would we win the league without Virgil van Dijk? No.
Mm. Yeah, I'd be surprised if there was many people questioning that selection. In a way, he's almost just taken for granted. Like, yeah. You saw Graeme Souness asking him after the match last night, do you ever break a sweat? He just makes it look so easy.
He does. I mean, that's, you know, it reminds me of Hansen in many, many ways, but very, very similar.
Better?
Better than Al. It's a close run thing. I mean, Al, if you think when Hansen started, he used to maraud through midfield all the time and like set people up, and what he couldn't do, Al, was score. He'd get through and miss it to fall apart. But he was. It's a very, very close run thing. But they are just so similar. I think probably with Virgil van Dijk, I mean, his heading ability is absolutely than Al, but it's a close one, and I'm not saying it because Hansen's my mate. It's very, very close. So they are definitely the best two that Liverpool have ever had, and they've had one or two decent ones.
How is Hansen? Because you never hear or see from him at all. Obviously, he was such a pivotal figure in so many people's lives growing up, watching him on Match of the Day. He was the main man on television for so many years, and obviously decided to retire, and unlike most people, just stepped away completely.
He always said that's what he was going to do. I see him on a semi-regular basis. In fact, if you go to Hillside Golf Course, you'll see him nearly every day, which is, he also lives in the closest house to Royal Birkdale Golf Course as well. Al's fine. But I think what he did, and I admire him for it, he just said, once he walked away from TV and radio and press, media, he said, I'm done. That's me, done now. I'm pretty sure he didn't even do anything for Kenny when he got knighted. I mean, they are massive pals, the two of them.
Right.
And he said to Kenny, look, if I do this, then I have got no reason when people ring up, I've got no reason why I have to say no. But he just said no, he's done his bit, and he's just, he golfs every day. He's a granddaddy. I think he's got, crikey, I can't remember now, I think it might be 4 or even 5 grandkids, and we all live extremely close. You know, there's 8 or 9 of us who live within. Mm. It is within a mile radius, so we see each other all the time, and it's just so funny because people come up to you and talk about, you know, different kind of stuff like that, and we're all like limping into the village and all that stuff. I find it hilarious, to be quite honest with you.
It's brilliant though, isn't it? It must be such a, like, it's a special thing that not many players, former players, have. Like, John Giles is on with us every Thursday night, was on earlier tonight, and often he'll speak about players of his generation who ended up in the scrap heap, who were treated so poorly by clubs when they were let go.
Sure.
And obviously, more and more money has come into the game in the last few years, and clubs are in a better position to involve former players, and Liverpool has become this behemoth, and there is work for former players, and they want their ambassadors, and they want you there at the ground. But it does mean that what you achieved isn't forgotten, and it gives you, maybe I'm over-egging it, but I get the sense it gives you a real purpose as well, that you are still relevant part of this club.
Yeah, it's great. And I mean, we jokingly, we'd say every year that they didn't win the league, we became better players, didn't we? And we said, bloody hell, they've knackered it now because they've gone and won it. But yeah, it is what it is, and people all have their opinions and stuff, but whenever we go to the ground, we're treated fabulously, and it obviously feels like another world. But you know, when we all get together, I mean, when the Birkdale lads are all out, so you've got Hansen, Dalglish, Whelan, Begling, Gillespie, me, Steve McMahon, Alan Kennedy. I've probably forgotten someone already, but within 20 seconds of being with each other, it's like we're back in the dressing room and the banter starts and the mickey taking and all that kind of stuff. That's what I miss more than anything, apart from maybe obviously wishing I was a lot fitter because of my age. But the banter's fabulous. And Hansen's the worst one because he remembers absolutely everything. You start telling a story and he'd jump in and go, no, that wasn't quite like that. It was like this. But it's great. And we've all got great memories, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, Jesus, when you say that, it's a shame that Hansen has stepped away to that extent, that if he's not coming back for Kenny Dalglish's knighthood, he ain't ever coming back.
No. Return of the man who never came back. That's what we say to him.
Jurgen Klopp then, I don't know if you've got to spend much time with him over the last four or five years. Mm. There was obviously the incident on the sideline last night between himself and Frank Lampard, and Lampard was giving him a little bit of that, and because there's nobody in the ground, the footage comes out, and you can hear exactly what they're saying to each other, and Lampard says, the first title you've ever won, you're giving it the effing big un. Which Klopp replies with a couple of expletives of his own, and Lampard comes out afterwards and congratulates Liverpool on winning the title, but basically warns them about becoming
arrogant. Yeah.
Is there a bit of arrogance in Klopp? Because I would suspect if you walked out in the street and said, even for non-Liverpool supporters, give us somebody you'd love to go for a pint with, Klopp would be right up there, man of the people. Is that a public persona, and is a very different man around the club?
No, there's a little bit of arrogance in him. I think that's a very Germanic thing anyway, to be honest with you. I mean, about their national team, whenever he used to play against German teams, there was always a little bit of arrogance, which I don't think is a bad thing in football. If people obviously believe in what they can do, and then obviously if they produce when they need to, then they deserve their arrogance. Mm. Yeah, there's a little bit of that, but it's also part of the game. And I think the biggest thing with Klopp, I mean, there's how long have you got, but there's lots and lots of things, but he has this fabulous way of just getting everybody together. You know, if you go to Melwood and he sees you but he's in a rush to go somewhere else, he still comes up, shakes your hand, well, obviously not at the moment, and, you know, how are you doing, excuse me, and all those kind of things. And he's been great with the old players, because he just said to his lads, he just said, look, this is what you want. Look at these fellas. Look what they've won. That's, you know, the boards at Melwood and obviously at the ground. And he said, don't let that frighten you. He said, but that's the standard that you've got to get to. And he's just a decent bloke. And I mean, I don't know if I've ever told you a story, Nathan, but he hadn't been here that long. And a friend of mine lived in the same village in Formby, and my mate Richard had taken his dog for a walk and stuff, and went into the pub on his way home before he got back to the house, just for a quick pint. And as I say, it was early in Klopp's reign, and it was on the road where Klopp lives, behind the wooden gates and everything. And Richard said to me, so I'm drinking my pint, and he said, Archie's dog is like sat at his feet drinking some water out of the bowl, and he said, I felt this figure alongside me. He said, as I looked at him, he looked at me, and Klopp said, you okay? And Richard said, yeah, I'm fine. And Richard said, you like it here? And he said, and Klopp said to him, like it? He said, what's there not to like? He said, it's £9.99 all you can eat. Now, I mean, how good is that? It's fab, isn't it? It's just, if that's not a normal person, that, you know, he's probably on about 8, 9, 10 million a year. Yeah, what bit of the £9.99 didn't you gasp? Great.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, he does seem to have very much bought into what Liverpool are all about. Mm. You spoke there about there was that time when, with every passing year, you became greater players, and the folklore and the history and the nostalgia, and you're wheeled out to tell the stories. Yeah. When you do look back at some of those groups of players who came through and who went close, do you ever think the weight of the history and having so many of yourself, Hansen, all these different figures constantly on the television,
no,
do you think that ever weighed on them?
No, I just think they weren't quite good enough. Don't get me wrong, they were very good players and they had some very good teams. They just quite weren't quite good enough. And I think, you know, the football club's obviously always been successful, or relatively obviously been successful, and it's always been there. And I can only, you know, when I went, I could have gone to Arsenal, Man United, Liverpool on the same day, and I just went, I'm going to Liverpool because I want to be part of a team that wins stuff and everything. And, you know, you say that, but you obviously, like, your fingers crossed thinking, crikey, I hope that's right. And I was lucky that it was. But I think there's a little something that's different between teams that win consistently with the other ones who are very, very good but don't quite win it. And it's not anything to do with hunger, because everybody wants to win all the time. It's just a certain little je ne sais quoi, which is, you know, this particular team have got between themselves, where they trust each other and they just manage when they play poorly to win games. I mean, you know what? Looking at the way the team have played this year, and majority of performances have just been outstanding. I occasionally think, crikey, you know, in the 80s, more often than not, we could be totally average, but we kept winning.
Right.
And that was the thing. We just kept winning. All right, the pitches were crap and everything, and you got, you know, every team had a big centre forward that used to try and knock me and Hansen out and all that stuff, and you just had to cope with all that rubbish. But we just managed to win. And I think that's it. And this lot have it, most definitely. Look at the way they play. Everybody knows the way that they play. They know about the fullbacks pouring forward, and they know when they do that Marnie on one side and Salah on the other side just tuck in and give them the width and everything. Nathan, hardly anyone can stop them.
Mm.
You know, and you know, you can video everything about Liverpool. They do not change the way they play. And I think, you know, it took Klopp a while just to get this press thing all the time. And eventually, everyone's grasped it. But if you see them train, by the way, at the start of the season, that he trains them like dogs.
Right.
He really, really does train them like dogs. And there's no let-up. It's not like...
And with ball at feet? Is that all replicating what happens in the match? Or
Everything you see in the game, he does in training. You know, they've been known to have three sessions in a day before today. So... you know, just hammers it home to everybody. And I think the clever thing with that with him is no one can turn around and say, oh, I wasn't quite sure what to do in those particular circumstances, because there's no grey area. There's just, it's black and it's white with Klopp.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. A couple of times over at Anfield, get a chance to maybe talk to one or two of the Liverpool players after the games, and you ask them about Klopp. And intensity is the word that comes up every time. Just how relentlessly intense he is on the training ground and how much he expects out of them. In terms of the style then, it feels as if it has evolved. Because you think back to a couple of years ago when they got to the Champions League final against Real Madrid.
Yeah.
Like, they were probably the best counter-attacking team in Europe at that stage. And it suited them so well against the best European teams because they could burst on the break and they had the talents of Salah and Mane. Like, now they're a team that push the centre-backs up right into the opposition half almost and just try and suffocate the life out of you. Do you think there's going to be another tactical evolution for next season?
No, but I think it'll stay as it is because it works.
Right.
And, you know, if you're, and I think against even the better teams, if you're making their midfield players play with their heads down and not be able to look up and pick passes, they're not brilliant midfield players, are they? You know, because then they just become ordinary because it's really, really difficult. And, you know, on the best days, Liverpool just hound the life out of everybody. You know, Firmino, we talked about him before, he's part of it. You know, he's responsible for kind of the width of the penalty area in terms of closing everybody down. And everybody knows it's just something that they have to do. And the other thing as well about it is you know, I don't really look at stats and stuff, but I bet Liverpool play more long balls than nearly any team, certainly in the Premier League and probably across most of Europe. If you look, when Liverpool kick off, what do they do? It goes back to, I don't know, whether it's Fabinho or even one of the back boys, and it goes diagonally to one of the sides, and it goes like 40, 50 yards, and you know. Sam Allardyce got slaughtered for playing long ball, but I mean it was basic. But Liverpool play as many long balls as they do short balls.
Just to finish off then on the, again, Van Dijk-Hansen comparison, and bring yourself into this as well, because they do, as you say, whether it's the two fullbacks playing those crossfield balls, they do them with such regularity they make it look so simple, or Van Dijk with that diagonal ball 40, 50 yards. Did you and Hansen have it in your locker to play those accurate, long, diagonal balls? And did you play them on a regular basis?
No, we probably couldn't reach. Big, heavy, muddy pitch.
Right.
No, we didn't. Listen, but the thing was then as well is, and everybody used to say about us sometimes, oh, they just keep the ball at the back, they pass it sideways and all that. Do you know what? We only ever did that when we were winning and we were just like want to knacker the opposition. But the first 20 minutes of any game, Ronnie Moran, who was only happy when he was unhappy, would slaughter us if we didn't look forward straight away in those games. Once you got comfortable and you were winning, then you could move the opposition around. But no, we didn't. We weren't that kind of way. And if you think about it, I mean, Craig Johnson or Sammy Lee would play on the right, and they'd play right on the touchline. But Ronnie Whelan was like left-sided midfield player in most of the teams, and he joined in the middle. So we didn't have that kind of luxury. And if you're right-footed, your natural way of a diagonal ball is to hit it from right to left, obviously. So no is probably the answer. But, I mean, Ronnie Moran would just be on your case straight away if he didn't look forward. And he'd be followed by a Mr. Sir Kenny Dalglish as well, who'd be like looking at you saying, why aren't you passing it to me, you Muppets?
And you could understand him.
What?
You could understand Kenny.
Say again.
You know whenever you're on, Mark, we like to get 2 gigs for the price of 1 out of you. You are, of course, Off the Ball's resident movie buff. And it's been a tough time for movie buffs because you can't go. Cinemas have been shut.
No.
So what have you been watching? What has been on in the Lawrence and household over the last few weeks?
Right, Netflix. Netflix has saved my life. So my favourite thing on Netflix I've watched is Ozarks.
Oh, yes. Marty Bird.
What?
Marty Bird.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, totally up there. But then I've been watching on a more sombre note. I watched Filthy Rich.
Yeah, that's a bit grim.
But do you know something? I've actually had lunch with Ghislaine Maxwell.
Right. How did that come about?
Well, when I managed Oxford, when I finished at Liverpool on the Thursday, I managed Oxford from the Friday, and of course I worked for a dad, Robert Maxwell, and Kevin Maxwell, his son, and I was invited to a couple of lunches of which she was at. I was actually very, very honoured because all the family were there, the immediate family, and me. And I'm sure I can say this on the radio because it's not really a problem. I remember one Sunday lunch that we had, and it was all their kids. Robert Maxwell and his wife and everything, and me, and we had a couple of glasses of wine and stuff like that, and Robert Maxwell did this thing where he would be asking them questions. They're all very, very bright and well-educated people, and he just stood up, slightly the worse for wear, and he pointed at Ghislaine, and he said, and primarily looking at the boys in the family, just went, she is the only person in this family with any balls. Well, look how that turned out.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, that went down an avenue that we weren't quite expecting.
Sorry about that. Well, listen, there's no films. I had to speak about something, didn't I? You led me down the garden gate.
We didn't. We opened it right up, and you had a somewhat of a personal interest in Filthy Rich then. Don't go down the Donald Trump line now if we were to ask you Ghislaine Maxwell out, wishing her well.
What did he say? I wish her well.
I wish her well. Exactly.
Jesus Christ, you've only got to watch that for 5 minutes. You think, how on earth?
Yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, it's as you say, it's a particularly grim story. So Ozark is in compared to Filthy Rich, Ozark is pretty much a comedy.
Yeah, Ozark is, and I watched El Chapo,
which is
the Colombian cartel. I seem to have seen loads of those. They're quite sort of easy.
There's a bit of a pattern emerging here. There's a lot of drugs in all these Netflix documentaries you're watching, Mark.
Well, I just find it absolutely fascinating. It's just like, you can't believe that it goes on, but it does. And we live in sleepy Birkdale, and you think, oh, my God, but I think even we've got a little bit of a problem here as well. But Ozark was just fabulous. I'll tell you what I also did. I rewatched Sopranos.
Ah, I still have never watched it.
Are you joking?
Much to my shame.
Oh, you've got to watch it. James Gandolfini, I mean, he's dead, and he died in Venice, didn't he? It's absolutely fabulous, and I then start looking things up on the internet, as you do. And you know, when they went to Cub to make the fifth or the sixth series, James Gandolfini was getting really kind of, he was getting all sorts of parts, all sorts of offers for all sorts of films, and they had to delay filming for 6 months while he waited to finish a film. And he came back and apologised to everyone and just said this: 6 or 8 major figures. He gave them $50,000 each, $50,000 to go and buy themselves a car each, and just to say sorry.
Wow.
Yeah, that's generosity. Proper bloke.
Well, on that note, Mark, pleasure as always. The cinemas, you can go now, can't you? Socially distanced somehow?
I'm not sure if they're open or they're not. You know, I've not even looked, and I don't know what's on anyway.
All right. Well, next time we talk, hopefully you'll have been back to the cinema, Mark. Great stuff as always.
Pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
All right, that is Mark Lawrenson. We will talk to Daniel Storey next about a calamitous night for Nottingham Forest.
We've had some great days and great nights and good memories. I hope that the people of Ireland have got... I know that they've got the memories. I know they cherish them, and I know that they've enjoyed the days that when they've done something that they've never done before. They go to a World Cup as part of it a couple of times. They've enjoyed that, and the European Championship.
Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me.
The president phoned me and said, would you like, the job is yours if you'd like it. And I said, I would like it. End of story.
I won't forget a single day, believe me.
Well, you know, we're 28-1, I think, we're quoted as, and we're not expected to do anything in this competition. We just hope to surprise a few people.
This kick by Sansomin goes Aldridge, and Houghton! 1-0!
Nowadays, you see, they've changed it. Everybody in Europe does a little bit of what we did. Everybody in Europe. But they've changed the name, the FIFA guys. They call it pressing. Because they don't want to tell us that we started it. We call it putting people under pressure.
Malta 0, Republic of Ireland 2. And history has been made in Malta. Jack Charlton achieving his victory. Achieving his ambition.
We've qualified for the Gold Italy and we've done it ourselves. I'm absolutely delighted, not only for me, for our lads and for all the fans.
The nation holds its breath. Yes,
and then I saw David coming, and I'm not the greatest believer in centre-backs taking penalties. And then David went back, put the ball down again, and went, sent the goalkeeper on, went, put it in, and it went fantastic.
We're there. We're in the last eight for the first time in my history, and it's magic. I'm delighted for the lads. And good luck to the people back home. Great. Hope they have a good time.
Burn came to me, and he said, our boss, he said, when we get to Rome, this you'll get us in to see the Pope, won't you? Well, that was where the final was going to be played, and I don't think they had a prayer again, but the final.
We prepared properly. We had a little bit of sun. We ate well. And we drank very little. We're going to change that tonight.
It's like religion, isn't it? And football's a bit like religion, isn't it? And Jack's... He'd be like a sort of... He's supposed to be like a pope or a bishop or something.
He would. It's not easy. Onto it comes Hope. And Hope with a shot. And it's there!
I went into the players and we just sat in the dressing room and we were getting changed and everything. And then somebody come and said to me, would you come out back on the pitch? I said, what for? He said, the crowd won't go home. I just remember, I just cried. It was time for me to leave. I'd been there for 10 years and it was time for me to leave. And I did.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Chasing down the competition with the momentum of a Man United Champions League charge.
Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
Welcome back to the Football Show this Thursday night. A reminder, the final day of the Premier League season will be live here on Off the Ball. Goals as they happen from all 10 matches and exclusive live commentary of Leicester against Manchester United with Stephen Doyle and Brian Kerr. If the final day of the Premier League is anything like the final night of the Championship, it is going to be a heck of a day because there was unbelievable drama at the top for the playoff places and in the relegation fight. Ultimately, West Brom were promoted alongside the champions Leeds United, and Wigan, with that 12-point deduction, look as though they're going to be relegated alongside Charlton and Hull. The main drama, though, came in the race for that final playoff place, where somehow Swansea City managed to nip in ahead of Nottingham Forest and take that sixth spot. I'm joined on the line by broadcaster and football writer Daniel Storey. Evening, Daniel.
Evening.
I've been reading quite a few articles about Nottingham Forest this evening, and the words misery, agony and pain of supporting this club have come up quite a bit. I'll take from your own article just to run through how calamitous this has been for Nottingham Forest over the last few weeks. So the 4th of July, up against old rivals Derby County, they lead 1-0 against 10 men to give themselves a 10-point cushion with five games remaining. Forest conceded. A minute left against Barnsley on the 19th of July, they had the point they needed to secure that playoff place. They conceded. 17 minutes left last night. final day of the season. They had the point they needed and a 5-goal advantage above Swansea City. They conceded 3 times. Swansea scored twice. And after 263 days inside the top six, somehow Forest have missed out. Dear God, it must be tough to be a Forest fan on days like this.
Yeah, it feels like you've read out one of my many nightmares to me. Yeah, I mean, it is horrible. Of course, it's hard to take. It should be said that if anyone thought that this could happen, it was Forest fans themselves. We'd not been playing very well since the restart. They've been chopping and changing in the team. They just hadn't got anything together. Maybe we didn't see anything of this magnitude, particularly the late goals, but we did see a home defeat coming and we did see this kind of creaking hold on the playoffs slipping away.
Mm. What was expected of Forest this season? Because I know from an Irish point of view, there'd been renewed interest in the club last year when Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane had gone in. But in general, Forest has been a bit of a mess for close on 2 decades at this stage. Was it a club that was expected to push for a playoff place?
Not from my personal point of view, no. I think I'd have been happy with upper mid-table and probably happy with seventh, albeit maybe not via this particular route. But I think you have to put into context the fact that they were in the playoffs for so long, that they were pushing for automatic promotion at one point, that they beat most of the teams. You know, they beat Fulham away, they beat Brentford, they beat Leeds. They equalised late on to draw at the Hawthorns against West Brom. They proved themselves capable against the best teams in the division, but they just had this horrible tendency to throw in cataclysmic results when we least needed them, and never more so in the final weeks.
Yeah, to make it even more frustrating, when you look at how the likes of West Brom and Brentford and Fulham played over the last few weeks, that actually, if they'd gone on to beat Derby that day and gone on a winning run till the end of the season, Forest could have achieved a whole lot more. Has there been, throughout this season, some sort of a mental weakness within this side that this sort of collapse occurred?
They've actually been a very different team to the one I expected. Until the restart, Forest fans expected Sabri Lamouchi, this name that came in from France, to maybe play kind of expansive football. But they were gritty and determined, and they ground out results that, quite frankly, they didn't deserve. You know, you look at things like expected goals, and Forest are way down in the table. Shots on target, they're way down the table. But they found a way. But they always had a tendency to go on after a nice winning run to just fall to earth very abruptly. And when that happens at Forest, and it's happened through different owners, players and managers, that seems to cause a loss of belief that ends in these mini disasters. And we've hit on another one, and it's no hyperbole to say that this one feels probably worse than all the others. We've had 4 playoff campaigns, we've never got beyond a semi-final, we've found a multitude of ways to exit that at that stage, but somehow this feels worse.
What about Sabri Lamouchi then, who came in and took over from Martin O'Neill, where I assume the style of football at Nottingham Forest under Martin O'Neill was quite similar to the style of football that we saw under Martin O'Neill with the Republic of Ireland, which, while quite often gets results, doesn't exactly inspire supporters. He came in as a relative unknown. I know he was with Rennes in France previous to this. Is he a manager that can now galvanise Nottingham Forest and over this break, over the next month before football resumes, can go into the transfer market, will get the backing he needs, and that we can expect Forest to be a force in the Championship again? Are there just too many unknowns around the club?
I think if you'd have asked me 3 months ago, I'd have said yes. He's brought through a number of young players. He's made a goal scorer out of Lewis Graben, a prolific goal scorer out of Lewis Graben, who scored 20 goals. That's the first Forest player to do that in years. But now I'm not so sure. It wouldn't surprise me if the owner, Evangelos Marinakis, who is by all accounts not a patient man, it wouldn't surprise me if he felt that now is the time for a change.
And right.
I don't necessarily agree with that, but I can kind of see why, because in this weird COVID-19 affected football championship, there's a very brief window between now and next season, and it's impossible not to think that this hangover is going to last and that these players and supporters are going to take a lot of picking up off the ground. And maybe the owner thinks that we're best cutting our losses at this point. It would be harsh on Lamouchi, but then, he had his chance, you might say. He had Forest in that commanding position and he let it go.
Oh, I can sense the frustration off you, Daniel. He brought you on a journey you weren't even expecting, and now because of the collapse, you're like, get rid of him. You're saying we can't bear to look at him in the dugout in 6 weeks' time because it'll just bring back too many bad memories.
That's it. He promised us the bike for Christmas when we never expected it, and all we got was Satsumas and nuts. This is it.
Yeah. Forest, obviously, over the last couple of decades, have had all sorts of ownership issues and have had such a dramatic decline on a par, if not worse, than what's gone on at Leeds United over the years. The current ownership structure, how is the club been run at the moment?
It's actually been pretty good. And one of the slightly ironic bitter blows from Wednesday night is that Forest have been here before, as I mentioned, but they've been here before under a chaotic or even an unideal setup. You know, no long-term structure, no off-field structure, no long-termism in the squad, managers being sacked almost every year. This felt different because it has been different, and yet we still end up in the same position. That's what makes this so hard to take. I do believe they're doing the right things. They've connected the supporters with the club. They've connected the community with the club, which hadn't happened. And that can only be a good thing. But that last giant to slay is that lack of belief and that propensity to fall into disarray when we need it least. And that will be the last, you know, that will be the last challenge. And it's going to take a big effort from here.
And there are so many unknowns as to what the Championship is going to look like next season in terms of parachute payments for clubs coming down. Are they going to be able to be maintained as to what sort of television revenue Championship clubs are going to be able to get? And it's such an unpredictable league at the best of times that, like, you can, as I say, you can sense your frustration. When you get a chance like you got over the last few weeks, you really have to take it. It's a league you just need to get out of.
It is. And, you know, there are many people of a certain age who would consider Forest a Premier League team. But the reality is they haven't been in there for more than 20 years now. Mm. And you get that on merit. You don't get that on past reputation or history or glory. You get it on merit. And Forest fans believe that we would deserve a playoff place on merit this season. And it wasn't to be. But one thing's for certain, it won't change next season. We'll only get there on merit again. If a club is in the right frame of mind and in the right structure, then next season should be another opportunity because, as you say, it will be financially very hard for a number of teams. And if Forest can rise above that, all power to them. But, it's going to take a heck of an effort psychologically.
You talk about Nottingham, the town, and the supporters and the people of the town getting the connection back with the club. For a lot of people, for maybe certain generations, were they just happy to wallow in nostalgia and think about the glory days and think about the history and the only club to have won more European Cups than league titles? And actually, they were happy getting into their later years with those memories and having to go along every Saturday and this drudgery of Championship football or League One football. Has that been a problem, actually, that for so long this was a big, a giant, a Premier League club, that for some people, they just can't put up with this?
I think that's probably true to say of certain supporters who maybe kind of moan or gripe that these aren't the glory days. But I think that past history is both a blessing and a burden. It's a blessing because even though I didn't witness it, I wouldn't change it for the world. It's an intrinsic part of my club, just as Brian Clough was. And I'm incredibly proud to have a club or support a club that is associated with those times.
But have you ever gone a day without mentioning Brian Clough's name?
I've never gone a day without thinking of him, I don't think. But it has been a burden because it has held back the club. And, you know, no one wants to erase that history, but Forest has to stand on its own two feet in 2020. As I say, that history doesn't count for anything anymore. So I think the club has moved on, but it has certainly, its new legacy almost is this propensity to collapse. You know, that is much more recent and much more regular than those glory days. They are in the past and they will remain so for a long time, perhaps forever with modern football as it is now. So I'm grateful for that, but I am wary of it becoming a burden.
Well, look, there's any amount of glory days on YouTube. Go cheer yourself up, please, Daniel. Watch some Brian Clough YouTube videos. The days will pass quickly and football will be back before you know it.
They just make me cry in a different way. It's fine.
Daniel, great to talk to you. Thanks a lot for taking the call.
Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Less flashy than a Jurgen Klopp smile, but just as effective.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.